It's time now for another episode of Lectionary Lab Live, brought to you by Two Bubbas and a Bible, and recorded live from wherever we happen to be, usually somewhere in Florida and in Brasstown, North Carolina. Welcome, everybody, to the Lectionary Lab Live. I'm John Fairless. I'm here with my Bubba, Delmer Chilton. Say hey, Bubba.
Hey, Bubba.
Hey, man. Good to hear from you today. I'm going to talk a little text. Get ready to preach. We're working today on the 21st Sunday after Pentecost. These are the texts for October 25th, 2020. End of October always brings a significant event around for you and our other Lutheran brethren and sistren. And I think you probably got a little bit to say about Reformation Sunday. And then we're going to get to Moses winding up his career and some other good stuff today. Tell me what you got on your mind, Bubba.
Well, you know, October 31, most people, it's Halloween. For Lutherans, it's All Hallows Eve and Reformation Day, the day Luther theoretically, supposedly, mythically, whatever you want to say, nailed those 95 feet to the church door in Wittenberg. We usually, in most Lutheran churches, it gets observed on the last Sunday of October. Right. So that would be this Sunday, and they always the same set of texts. So I'm going to take just a few minutes because we have a lot of Lutheran listeners as well as Reformation Sundays on the Presbyterian calendar, I know, and a few others may do it.
Right.
But the text for Lutherans is always Jeremiah 31 about writing it on your hearts, you know, the Holy Spirit. And we have Romans, you know, when talking about Abraham, it was reckoned to him as righteousness and that sort of thing. And John, you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free. So those are the texts year after year, and you've been doing it for a while as a Lutheran. You begin to say, what else can I say about Reformation? I have one word of warning. Try to do the best you can to avoid triumphalism. I think most people that I know of as good Lutheran pastors, they just don't go out and beat up on the Roman Catholic Church and then say that God inspired Luther to totally restore the gospel that nobody had known for 1500 years.
Oh, buddy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're all kinds of Protestants are capable of that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
And I think one of the questions is to, using a good Lutheran law and gospel kind of approach is to say, okay, we know in what ways the medieval church perhaps it obscured the of God. This day centers on a discovery of the grace of God, both all the way through the Hebrew scriptures. Look at both Jeremiah and the reference in Paul is to things that happened in the Hebrew scriptures. Abraham believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness, and Jeremiah, it'll be written on their hearts. And so, it's not just we suddenly realized it and nobody else had ever known it. It's about this of God. And continually we obscure it. So one of the questions I think if you're preaching Reformation Sunday 2020 is say, what have we put into place of the grace of God that says we are justified? Hmm. What are the things we've said we have to do or we have to believe or we have to, all anything, any human construct, either of thought or behavior that we have created that makes us feel like that we have done enough and God will have to love us, not because God is love, but because God will have to. And I think preaching on this Reformation Sunday is to dig down to a reminder that it's all of God's grace. There you go. I'm done with Reformation Sunday for another year.
There you go. Well, and all I can is for people of a particular persuasion in the Baptist tradition can go at least one up, if not three or four up on you with The Trail of Blood by J.M. Carroll, tracing the unbroken line, those times unseen, from John the Baptist, who founded the Baptist Church and came all the way through to Jesus, the apostles, had to go underground for a while, and anyhow, to the this very day today, unbroken succession of Baptist church history. You can tell sports fans that I'm not exactly a subscriber to that theory.
Are you trying to tell me that the Lutherans aren't the only ones that are going to get to heaven and be surprised that there's somebody else there?
Could be, you know, it could be. So we all have our oddities, don't we? Just a theological, this is just a theological oddity. We've all. Well, let's get to some text for today then, Bubba. And,
So
everybody putting up with us a little every now and then.
The text for Pentecost 21, the theme that I see running through them all, and I think this is something just to pay attention to, is what I would call the suffering of the servants of God, or the prophets of God, or the preachers of God, the proclaimers of God. In each of these texts, there is, you can look at it and say, well, that's not fair. That's not, if that's a Teresa of Avila, there's a story about she was riding a carriage to from one convent to another, and she got out of the carriage. It was pouring down a rainstorm. She got out, slipped on these wet rocks, fell in the mud, and her response was to look up at heaven and say, "Well, God, if this is how you treat your friends, no wonder you have so few of them."
Oh, we are inclined to feel that way some days.
And so each of these, you got Moses, you've got the writer of the Psalm, which traditionally, and I'll mention this, was Moses. And then you got Paul and his companions, we, who are talking about their affliction. And then you got Jesus on the tail end of just being harassed by these various leaders with these various questions where they're trying to trap him. And you look and go, well, that's not fair. They agreed to serve the Lord. They're preaching the Lord's word. Mm-hmm. That should work for them, according to what I've heard. You know, quit your meanness, join the church, serve God, and God will bless you.
Right.
Well, not so much, according to these texts. So that's something to look at. Embedded in the Matt Gospel is this wonderful, what is the greatest commandment? And I think ultimately this is about loving our neighborly enemies. How is it that, and I just find that very interesting that Jesus responds to this long series of being put upon by people he's trying to proclaim the good news of the kingdom to. And he's able to look them in the eye and say, love the Lord your God with all your heart and mind and soul. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself, whether you feel like it or not. Mm-hmm. So,
and as a matter of fact, it all hangs on those.
Yep.
That's it. All the law, all the prophets, everything. You know, you just,
this and is I think, what it comes I think down to really get others. The import at this moment in this text is to realize the situation, the context in which Jesus is saying that.
Yep.
The human part of him is probably gritting his teeth a little bit. So let's move to Exodus.
Let's get Moses. Let's give Moses the ending he deserves here.
This is kind of this Exodus 34, 1 through 12. There's a kind of Victorian death scene going on here. I use Victorian as kind of shorthand for English literature sentimentality. You know, you can almost see them going in and people standing around and people waiting for the last words, and you know, it's sort of built around that. So this divides out into basically three sections with one little interregnum there. The first section is the build up, the thing. He goes up on the mountain. He sees everything. This is hyperbole, exaggeration for the sake of emphasis. There's no actual place in that area where you can stand and see all of that at one time. So it's kind of literary and shows Moses everything and then says, see, I brought you to the promised land, but you're not going in. It's almost cruel. You know, it's like, here's what I would have given you for, if you hadn't been bad, we're going to send it back. But I wanted you to see it.
Like the old, let's make a deal and you pick the wrong door and Monty goes ahead and shows you what you could have had.
What you could have had.
Yeah.
So there, and of course there is a question that comes, you know, and it's outside of this text, is the question of why can't he go? Well, it's one of which is because of the continual rebellion he and the last one too much. And he said, nobody who came out of Egypt is going to go in. Only your children are going to go in. We'll come back to that in a little bit. So Moses himself in his sermon, one of his early sermon on Deuteronomy says, you know, you're angry with me because of these people, you know, that blanket thing. There's another tradition, and it's mentioned in, I think it's Numbers, where, you know, he said they wanted water, and he was supposed to take, he said, take the rod, and I'll show water from the rock. Moses struck the rock, and he had not been instructed to do that. So one interpretation was that he had failed to show faith and trust in God and tried to add a human action to it. I don't think it much matters. You know, the issue is that completely for us, the story is that even Moses didn't go in. No one who left Egypt.
Yeah, I agree. I've heard lots of permutations and discussions. Moses didn't get to go in, and how he failed God. I don't think this text tells us Moses failed God. In fact, the opposite is true. Nobody could have done more than Moses. Nobody at the end of it was more faithful than Moses. But, you know, I think there's a word for us pastors and leaders here.
Yeah,
we're not perfect. We never will be. But like Moses, we need to stick with the work. It is hard to emerge unscathed from this work. And, well, you know, this is not about a final reward for any preachers or leaders or whatever, but it's tough. Hang in there. And in the end, at the end of it, God is in control and God's going to take care. This is what I see in the care with which Moses is laid to rest.
Yeah. Well, and you know, for me, the, you know, when Jesus says, take up your cross, it's not a new idea. This is what one of the things I want. Not only is the mercy and grace of God all throughout the scriptures, but also the fact that it's about faithfulness, not success. You are called to take up whatever cross God gives us, whatever burden, whatever need. And, you know, Moses could have been probably fairly happy just sort of in retirement. Tending the sheep, and then the burning bush came, and look how his life ended up. And the issue was not reward. He led the people out. He brought them home. He got them to the promised land. He didn't get to go in. The issue is faithfulness. Faithfulness and not success is the way of following Yahweh. And I think, as you say, the Christian life is that. The life of faith is that, following God, wherever that may lead. So verses 1-4, you know, then 5-8, you got the death of Moses, and you know, it's just an interesting thing. The issue of his, no one knows where he was buried. It's kind of like, don't go make a shrine to Moses. It's basically what it amounts to. Then you get down to the third section, this sort of interregnum, this one verse about Joshua, but it's full of some interesting stuff. You know, I would preach an ordination on this spirit. There is the spirit in, not the Holy Spirit capitalized as we would in Christian theology, but the spirit of God, the spirit of wisdom, someone to be wise. And there you have the laying on of hands, the passing on. So there you get the first half of that. You've got the person who is ordained, and then, and the Israelites obeyed him, doing as the Lord had commanded Moses. It's kind of the pastoral relationship kind of thing. I think some of us, and most of us I'm talking to today, are people who in one way or another are leaders in the church. That's a text to meditate upon. What has been passed on to us? Where is God's spirit, and what wisdom do we receive?
Absolutely. What's been passed on to us, and as you say, from early on in the text, it's easy for us sometimes to feel a little put upon, to feel like there's a level of suffering, that there are things that just aren't fair. But you really have to come to grips with, what is my role? What is my call in the midst of the people of God, in the midst of the church, capital C, in the midst of this particular church or congregation? And, you know, will I get through and say, I did what I was called to do, and leave it there?
And then the last part of this text, 9 through 12, is what you might call the eulogy or the epitaph that could have been put on it. You know, it's one of those, what you'd read in an obituary, you know. Never since has there arisen a prophet in Israel like Moses, et cetera, et cetera. And it sort of goes through, knew God Lord face to face, and it just recalls what he had done and all the terrifying displays of power Moses performed, and the mighty acts of God. And that's kind of where this text ends. So you've got the sees the promised land. He's not going to get to go in. He dies. He's buried. His mantle is passed on to Joshua. And then they say, and what a wonderful guy he was. And nobody's ever going to be like him. Then you move to the Psalm.
Oh, wait, you forgot one thing. There's a famous verse that's omitted here. Verse 13, it said, and then everyone was invited to the fellowship hall for a mighty fine dinner prepared by the ladies of the tabernacle.
All right. Thank you for that. That must have gotten edited out of my new revised
standard. It was. That's.
All right. Psalm 90 is traditionally, at least among Jewish commentators and others, and some Bibles that will attribute it to a Psalm of Moses as opposed to a Psalm of David, the only one that's attributed to anyone other than David. And that's interesting to know as you see this, because it envisions Moses on the mountain between being told he was seeing the promised land and he's not going in, and before his death praying to the Lord, because this is a communal lament. A complaint, if you will, about the shortness and toil and trouble of life. And it pretty much contrasts God as eternal and humans as temporary, God as holy and humans as sinful. And it has a couple of grace notes when it talks about God's compassion. Verse 13, how long? Have compassion on your servants. It's a plea. And then in verse 17, let the favor of the Lord be upon us and press. But most of the Psalm is envisioned as him saying, I'm 120 years old. And that wasn't long enough.
It's never
life
done,
is short. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, I think the tie-in with Moses, we have to come to grips with, if we expect life to be continually successful and pleasant, we have misunderstood what it means to be a part of the kingdom of God, because from the very beginning, God's kingdom had to do with others, not just about Yahweh, but the things you do for others. And look at Moses. What did Moses do this for? Well, for the people of Israel who were in slavery. He wasn't in slavery anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah. God says to give up that which you are your benefit for the sake of others. And it continually does that. We do this for others, not for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that's a hard sell in America. And you know, even the best of us, we think about how, you know, American individualism and our rights and the fairness has to do with everybody having a fair chance to win rather than fairness being everybody wins together. That's a contrasting point. And you got to say, where are we falling this as we look at these texts? What does this mean? And we have to let the hammer of God, as it were, that breaks the stone of our hearts. Mm. We have to look at it and say, what is this saying to us about who we are if we're going to follow God? So.
Going to need to let God change the leopard spots and melt the heart of stone.
Yes, indeedy. And you know, even when we get to that point, and this is important, even we continually make it individualistic. So then I become not a bad person in the individual things I do, and I become a good person in the individual things I do. And continually, I believe that Yahweh calls us to lift our eyes from ourself to community. And to the greater good. And I think this happens over and over again. And we're called this is why the God, I'm center coming back to the gospel. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. Yeah. And the second is like unto it. Love your neighborly enemy like yourself. And I say that advisedly, because as many times as he says, love your neighbor, he says, love your enemy. Hmm. And I think they go together. I just want to emphasize that all the way through this.
Well, that's it. You can't always choose your neighbors, and you may well be neighbor to an enemy. And so love your neighbor is kind of an all-inclusive text.
Yeah.
Love those that are like you. It's
no. And your neighbor is not necessarily the person who lives next door. That's how we do it. The neighborhood. Neighbor is anybody in the world that you can find a way to help.
We better move on, Mr. Moving to Rogers.
First Thessalonians. Mr. Delmer's neighborhood. First Thessalonians 2:1-8, Paul is writing to the church at Thessalonica. Notice the we at the last week we read where he lists all the people that are with him. So this is the we. This is not the royal we, as the Queen of England says. This is me and my buddies.
Yeah.
That were there. And there's an unspoken comments from Thessalonica about, well, since y'all left, they got these other fellows in here and they're a lot more interesting to listen to. But on the other hand, they keep asking for money and we're not sure about what they're saying. And I think all of that's underneath this as he responds. First of all, there's though we had already suffered and been shamefully mistreated at Philippi, as you know, we had courage in our God to declare to you the gospel of God in spite of great opposition. So Paul is saying, some of what I've just been saying, this is not about making love you and like you. This is about telling the truth. And he contrasts it with verse 3. Does not spring from deceit or impure motives or trickery. And verse 4, not to please mortals, but to please God. And then you get down to verse 5, we never came with words of flattery or with a pretext or greed, nor did we seek praise from mortals. So what he's doing is saying, okay, remember what we said to you and how we said it. We just told you the truth. Mm-hmm. No greed. We could have let y'all support us. We never made demands.
I love that, the way he slides that in. Now, we might have made some demands as apostles.
We're way up here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we were gentle, like a nurse caring for her own children. determined to share with you not only the gospel of God, but also our own selves. We didn't stand apart. We were part of your life. The point is that he makes a simple statement of the kerygma and lets the chips fall where they may. I remember the first time I flew out of the country, and I flew to England to go to Oxford for a couple of weeks for the continuing ed. I don't want to claim I was a student at Oxford. I was a student in Oxford. But I got off the plane in London, and I was not accustomed to going through customs. And the guy asked me, he said, "Do you have anything to declare?" I said, "I declare I'm right tired." He was not amused.
He did not get that creaturely, mountainly humor, did he?
Yeah, no. And then I found what declare meant, and I said, "No, nothing. I declare nothing at all." And I think about that a lot, and I think the church often has nothing to declare.
Oh, mercy. Yeah.
And, or if that which we have to declare is what we think will attract others. So we talk about our nice building and our good fellowship and how we love, everybody here loves each other, and we have wonderful fellowship meals, and our preacher is so good looking. I never said that about me, but you know. And then the choir is so, you know, and none of that's.
No, we.
And everybody has such a good time, and we got a softball team and whatever you got. And the question, none of this is trickery exactly, but it's not trusting that if we proclaim and live out the love and grace of God, that's what we're called to do. And so the question here is, what is it we put in the place of the gospel? Because we don't quite trust it.
Wow.
Paul's calling us, both as individuals and as preachers and as a congregation, to say, what do we have to declare? What is our message? Mm-hmm. And we need to examine ourselves if we're flattering the world around us or a pretext of greed. We need more people in the pew because we're going to need more money to keep this place going.
Right.
Absolutely. Or deceit or trickery or whatever it might be. And then I came to that is I went to visit the family one time in Nashville, and the church was small, and before it started growing, and they had three kids, and they asked if we had a youth ministry, and I said, "Well, with yours, we're up to five, mine and yours." That's a youth ministry.
There you go. We've got a crew building.
Yeah.
You're exactly right. And here's an image I'm working with. I've been working with my congregation through these epistles. And so I'm trying not to shoehorn too much here, but I'm really intrigued as he gets to the end of that. And he uses the, "We were gentle among you, like a nurse tenderly caring for her own children." And my thoughts are building around, you know, what is this part within the fellowship that we do when we do care for one another, or when we do care for neighbor, with the background not only of the gospel text for today in mind, but also the background of the Good Samaritan text, the parable that we, you know, that we have there. Being a neighbor is the one who goes and cares for others, sometimes in sort of desperate straits. But I start thinking about a nursemaid here. What do? They look after the children. But that includes a lot of things. You got to be sure people are fed. You got to be sure children are being nourished. For better or worse, you got to clean up their mess, which, depending on the child, may be anything from a diaper on up to, you know, what they messed up trying to, you know, lead a committee or do whatever. Part education, part discipline. Okay, no, we don't do that, young Dilmer. Well, why not? Well, because, you know, so on and so forth. But I love the gently among you. It's all out of love. And again, you've got the tie to the gospel. What's really important? Loving God, loving your neighbor, loving yourself. So I'm playing around with that a little bit, and the deep care that comes from this fellowship in the spirit that we share.
Well, I agree. It's interesting. It's interesting to play with, and I'd have to get back to the Greek, which I haven't done at this point, where it says like a nurse tenderly caring for her own children. So is that contrasting the nurses who cares for other people's children mm-hmm. with the deepness with which she cares with her own? Yeah. And it ties so deeply, do we care for you, that we share our own self. So either way, a nurse that's totally devoted, not only stands back and says, when's my shift over, but gives all for their own children.
Yeah, you know? And it does, and it bespeaks this whole relationship. You might put it into a nurse and say, does she consider the children she cares for her own? I've encountered a lot of good church folk over the years talking about my kids that have been through my Sunday school class.
Yep.
You know, you've got a great story about Mrs. Edwards or somebody, your Sunday school teacher.
Yeah.
Doing the best she could, probably pretty. Well, these are my kids.
These are my kids.
And it may be a physical relationship or it may not, but we have to remember we are all God's children, somewhat by adoption.
Yeah.
There's that whole thing too. So, yeah, there's a good chance to stir around it, this image.
Yeah. So Matthew 22:34-46 falls out into two basic sets. 34-40 is kind of the tail end of this series of harassing questions that began back in 21 where the kind of the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the lawyers, the scribes, the Herodians, you make your list, tag teamed on Jesus. All of the power structure, if you want to put it in those kind of terms, have decided he's dangerous and they're trying to do something that will get him in trouble. They've trying to get in trouble with the Romans by trying, you know, with is it right to pay taxes? They're trying to get him in trouble with the people. They're trying to find something they can charge him with. And I love this. When the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. So, well, they were opposite, they're enemies, you know, the Pharisees and the Sadducees to some extent, or at least rivals. So this team of rivals has just been trying to do something. They heard that he had bested the Sadducees, so they figured it was their turn. Asked him a question to test him. Teacher, which commandment in the law is the greatest? Well, you know, he's not talking about the Ten Commandments. They're talking about the related kind of assessment of 613, which the Pharisees, who were trying to strictly observe all the law, their main understanding was it all hung together. To fail to do one was to fail to do all. So this is in some ways a trick question, because anything he picked in their theory, then they could say, oh no. And he wanted to get an argument going. But Jesus, again, is too smart for him. One of the things he did, he gave a very traditional Orthodox Jewish answer. He went to the very core with the Shema. Deuteronomy 6:5, Lord, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and a lot, you know. So he went there. And then this text, the second part of this, love your neighbor as yourself, is from Leviticus 19, and it's quoted at least three times. Matthew, this is the third time. And it comes up in the other gospels. And so he did not go with anything new. He went to the very core. And when he says these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets, what he is saying is, you tried to get me to pick one of the 613. I'm an originalist. I'm going back to the Constitution. This is the basis on which it all stands.
Yeah.
And
that was sly.
secondly, just to say, anytime anybody teaches the Ten Commandments, it's two tables. And the first table is what you owe to God. Those are the first three or four, depending on how you count them. And the second table, the last six or seven, are about loving your neighbor. You shall love the Lord, you know, have no other gods before me, honor the Sabbath, etc. And then it's about mother and father and law, and not stealing and not killing and no adultery, not lying. And he summarized it in these two, those two commandments, the two tables, love God, love your neighbor. There's nothing they can argue with. He silenced them. I love a Chesterton quote. More people are familiar with Chesterton for the Father Brown Mystery's Own Masterpiece than they are for some of his other writings. He's a great writer, early 20th century on Christianity and other topics. And he said, in one place, Jesus tells us to love our enemies. In another, he tells us to love our neighbors. This is because, generally speaking, they are the same people.
That is it. That's part of the crux of what's going on here today. Again, back to the suffering of the proclaimer, the preacher. That's not just preachers, pastors in the pulpit. That's for everyone. You know, this may be tough to do. This may actually cost me something. This might actually hurt a little bit. It's part of the call.
It's part of the call. Then the second part of this text, 41 through 46, is when Jesus basically says, all right, it's time to stop this. At least in Matthew's construction of the story. Yeah. He's put all of these questions, and then he silenced them. Notice that line, from that day did anyone dare to ask him any more questions. It's like, all right, I'm done. And he asked them what is essentially one of those unanswerable riddles. You know, he goes back to the psalm and it has a text that I wouldn't say he took a text out of context and made a pretext out of it. I would say it was a stretch of an exegesis, shall we say. But basically, he's got, if it's a psalm of David, by David, and he refers to the Messiah as his Lord. And yet we say that the Messiah is a descendant, say, son of David. Then how can David refer to one of his descendants as his Lord, who would be above it? And they got no one was able to give him an answer.
I got nothing.
You know, it's one of those unanswerable things, which it was polite way in the world that Jesus could have said, y'all shut up. I'm tired. I'm done.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about this anymore.
Yeah. And we're finished here.
Let's move on. It is also within this is this, this issue of bringing up the issue of the Messiah. Who is the Messiah? And Jesus is implying, I'm the Messiah, within context, I think, as they push these questions. That's the undercurrent here, because he brings up, at least for Matthew, is to say, not only can you not answer me how he could say that, you need to and I think the message to the early church, the unspoken, because that's who Matthew's writing to, is that he's saying to them, you have been questioning the Messiah. Have you not figured that out yet? You're not going to be able to pull off. I think in terms of this text, I don't know how much emphasis and preaching one would put on this latter part. I think it's important for Matthew, but for proclamation, I think I would center more on the like second is like unto it, and how that line 40 on these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. And it just goes back to that basic core that runs throughout, is that our calling in life, if we commit ourselves to love God, there is no way we cannot love our neighbor. They go hand in glove, and you can't separate them. And this is just a consistent thing. And you go all the way back to Moses. He committed himself to the voice in the burning bush, which led him to 40 years of loving the children of Israel in spite of themselves. You got Paul, who had a pretty good academic career going, as we can tell, and is on the road to Damascus, and he answered a call to love God with soul, heart, mind, and soul. And he spent the rest of his life as an itinerant, being run out of towns for what he said, ends up dying. Because for the sake not only of his fellow Jews, but also for Gentiles, whoever else that God called him to love wherever they were. And all of that stems right out of this very message. You shall love your neighbor as yourself because you love God. Then they're the same thing.
All right, man. Well, as always, great text, good thoughts. Thank you for your careful analysis and leading us to think through these items. Preachers, teachers, pastors, those of you that will be seeking to communicate from these texts in your congregations, you do have our thoughts and prayers, our very best wishes as you stand to proclaim. Bubba, I don't reckon there's much else for us to do today, really, other than to tell everybody bye.
Everybody bye.
Lectionary Lab Live is a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Our opening theme is The Jam, performed by Slink and Mr. Stabilina. We go out today with What the World Needs Now Is Love, composed by Burt Bacharach and Hal David, performed by Miss Jackie DeShannon of Hazel, Kentucky.
Not just for some, but for everyone. Lord, we don't need another mountain. There are mountains and hillsides enough to climb. There are oceans and rivers enough to cross, enough to last till the end of time. What the world needs now is love, sweet love. It's the only thing that there's just too little of. What the world needs now is love, sweet love. No, not just for some, but for everyone. Lord, we don't need another meadow. There are cornfields and wheat fields enough to grow. There are sunbeams and moonbeams enough to shine. Oh, listen, Lord, if you want to know. For some